want to help prepare the next generation of leaders to face an uncertain future with kindness, curiosity, and ambition.
Wouldn't it be?
All right, welcome to Diaries of a Mortal Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Arvind Nagarajan, and this is month 5. So first, got to start with a little housekeeping. I know it's video is long overdue, and frankly, I've been avoiding this. It's a lot easier to record when you feel positive and things, you feel like things are going well. A lot harder to generate the activation energy when it doesn't feel like things are going well. But that's part of the accountability of doing this, and that's part of the reason why I called it Diaries of a Mortal Entrepreneur. It's a diary is not about just sharing the ups. It's about sharing the overall process. And so I'm going to try to push through, get back on the horse here, and provide an update for month 5. So I'll just share a couple frustrations and then share a couple things that just have piqued my interest in this space. But I really am feeling like it might be easier to switch to a written format. I don't feel like I'm putting the requisite effort in to make YouTube a success, just in terms of feeding the algorithm and what that needs. And you know, the diary format kind of fits better with a written form anyways. So it might switch to a newsletter. So let's start with the two things that frustrated me. So one is, you know, in my previous job, I did a lot of cold calling. It was essentially a form of sales. I'd have a long list of potential schools to get in touch with. I'd go through the list, try to call them, and get a meeting. And in most cases, you don't even get through to the right person. They don't take your call. They don't want a meeting. And that's just part of the numbers game. That's why you have a lot of numbers that you go after and a lot of forms of contact, and you just work through that list. Here in this situation right now, I'm identifying my own list of people I want to talk to, people that I think could help me bring the high school of the future to life. When you design your own list and when you, you know, put a lot more of your personal self-worth into, you know, researching these people, trying to come up with the right, crafting the right message, doing whatever you can to get the meeting, it hits a lot different than a regular cold call. Like the emotional weight of rejection, just complete lack of reply, is a lot more demoralizing than I expected. Yeah, it's the rational side of me says, of course, I need to expect this, need to do better at trying to figure out warm ways in to potential interesting stakeholders and just consistently play the numbers game with less emotional attachment. But it has been demoralizing to try to reach out to people. And if any of you have good tips for how to get someone's attention, I'm all ears. You know, I'm trying to identify the right emails, craft the right message, going with different, if it's not email, sometimes I'm sending physical letters in the hopes that that could break through the noise a little easier. So I'm trying different things, but yeah, if there's any unconventional strategy, I just read one that was you put your letter inside a FedEx envelope, and then in the envelope inside the FedEx envelope says, please hand deliver or something like that. And apparently that has a much higher rate of actually getting opened by people of importance. So anyways, any strategies or tips, throw them down in the comments, help a fellow entrepreneur out. Second frustration is, you know, my longtime work partner, Caitlin Donnelly, has this thing where she always says, you know, I want to invest in people who are doing their life's work, you know, like fulfilling their purpose. And I love that. It's a great, it's always stuck with me because it's a nice way of thinking about, okay, these are the things You know, like this is someone who's really passionate. They're not just an entrepreneur who sees a money grab opportunity, but they're in this because they care, and that'll sustain them through the ups and downs. And just like with all things related to this, as I've been trying to craft the pitch, craft the narrative, what I'm trying to do, what makes this different, you know, why do you want to send your kids to this high school of the future? I feel like that, that GIF, like the, like it's so clear in my mind, but when it comes out, it's just not coming with the clarity and the understanding that I'm hoping to convey. The words, you know, when people hear it, they have feedback about why it's not so good from a marketing standpoint, how you need to hit parents a certain way. And I hear all that, but it's tough trying to organize. It's tough trying to come to that synthesis. And, you know, even like when it comes to like, what is my life's work? What does this all boil down to? What am I doing this for? Finally had like a moment of clarity. And I know there's probably some issues with the wording here. And, but to me, this makes perfect sense. When I think about it, it's like my life's purpose. Like, why is this my life's work? My life's work is to help prepare the next generation of leaders to face an uncertain future with kindness, curiosity, and ambition. That, to me, is the clearest way I can put it. Again, let me say it. I want to help prepare the next generation of leaders to face an uncertain future with kindness, curiosity, and ambition. There's a whole bunch of other things that the next generation must be prepared with in terms of skills, knowledge, et cetera, whether they get into the right college or so much. But when I boil down what I believe my purpose is, I think that's the best way I can summarize it. Like so much, it's like, you know, an uncertain future. I believe the future is, I'm not a doom and gloom, nor am I a techno-optimist, but I do believe we're going to be facing greater uncertainty when it comes to the future. And so there's a certain types of skills that will be best suited to facing that uncertain future. Top of the list being your ability to pay attention. And that's what I mean when I say face that uncertain future. There's going to be more and more ways to distract yourself. And when it comes to kindness, curiosity, and ambition, I thought a lot about the words, the traits that really matter. And if I really had to boil it down to three, of course, there's a plethora of words you can choose from that are all great to have. But if I had to boil it down to three, those are the three. And each of them I thought a lot about in terms of how you cultivate curiosity. What does ambition really look like? What is a pure form of ambition? There's some really great writing by David White on this subject. And kindness, I think that is fundamentally such an important element to maintain for the next generation of leaders. So anyways, that's one minor breakthrough in a larger narrative struggle that I'm having in terms of how I get my message crisp, clean, and ready to talk to different audiences about. So those are the frustrations, but let's shift gears to talk about some of the things that have been kind of piquing my interest in the last couple of weeks. One, I'm really obsessed, been thinking a lot about the Lindy effect. And for those of you who don't know, the Lindy effect is basically this idea that however long something has existed, either an idea or technology, something, that's the best indicator for how long it is going to last in the future. So as like a tangible example, books have been read for however many hundreds of thousands of years. Therefore, books as a medium are likely to continue to exist for thousands of years. Whereas VR goggles are very recent. They've only been around for a few years, so they're likely to not exist hundreds of years in the future. So this is just a basic mathematical principle that however look to age as a filter for great ideas. And I heard this best expressed. It came back even though I'd been thinking about it for a couple of weeks, I just heard it in this podcast from a guy called David Perel with Amor Towles, who is the author of A Gentleman in Moscow, which was my book of the year in 2023. And it's just an epic piece of writing. And he actually describes this Lindy effect in different terms. Well, let me just play the clip here.
If you think of time or history or whatever you want to call it, history is not very good at capturing all that is great in art. It is not good at that. So there are many great symphonies that have been lost permanently. There are many great painters that died unknown and their paintings are gone. There's novels that have been written that no one will ever read. So history is not good at capturing all this great in art. But history is very good at discarding all that is mediocre. So, and the amount of time that takes, it's like something like 50 years. So over the course of 50 years, what will happen is a lot of stuff that was prominent will be refiltered, and you'll end up with a smaller group of things which have survived that test of time. And so, like, if you think about it right now, if you go back and look at the bestseller list for 1974, 1973, there's a lot of that that would have been highly regarded at the time, which people do not read anymore for a variety of reasons. And there's some that has survived. And that's a very telling distinction. So in a world where we have, I'm turning 60 this year, you have a limited amount of time. All four of us have active lives. We want to make sure that if we're going to sit down, we're going to read carefully, we're going to meet, and we're going to discuss it in detail. We want to make sure that the work is rewarding. And the best way to ensure that is by drawing from the past.
Amen.
So I love that as a filter. It's like, to me, art is either going after something truly ephemeral, truly something in the moment where you're just capturing the zeitgeist and sharing some universal sentiment, or is going for something that's trying to be timeless, that's trying to take advantage of this Lindy effect, that is going to be something that we look after 50 years later. And it's such a good point that we spend way too much time looking at recent things, at the ephemeral forms of art, instead of the timeless forms of art. And looking to the past for that is such a great reminder when you're thinking about what you need to learn. And what you want to learn, the ideas you want to expose your brain to over time. And you think about whether that's social media or whether that's more, you know, how you get more timeless forms of knowledge or wisdom into your life and into your habits. So anyways, that's just a thought bubble that is really, really on my mind. But speaking of the ephemeral forms of art, like these internet think boys, I'm a huge fan of several of them. And it's funny to think of these blog posts and like which blog posts will still be around in a decade. Things that you think are interesting forms of writing. It's whether you'll care, whether it'll be relevant, whether it's interesting a decade from now, probably not the case. And it kind of changes how you think about approaching any form of art, content creation of any type. First one, okay, one of my OGs from an internet think boy standpoint is Packy McCormick. I think his writing's fallen off over the years, but I still am a religious reader of most of his content. But this is a complete separate note. I thought it was so interesting in this article a couple of weeks ago. He's talking about how you need to experiment before you get something right. And he uses the example of Steve Jobs right before they released the iPhone. The year before that, they launched this Motorola iTunes phone. And it's funny because he points it out as such a disaster. And she says, like, you don't have to watch that whole video, but if you want a little hit of cringe, start at 10:50, where Steve lets the COO of Singular Wireless come on stage to do a corporate stand-up comedy routine. So he absolutely roasts this video. So I watched it just to see the cringe. Here, I'll play the clip.
Now, let me tell you what you're going to see next. You're going to see three
television commercials that are start playing tomorrow. Not one, you're going to see three that are going to be in the mass market. So we're not just going to be outdoor. We're going to hit the market with three commercials. And guess what? Not just in English, but also in Spanish. And I wonder why they got the Spanish influence kind of thing. I don't know. So what I want to do is roll the next three commercials, watch it, and see if you get the idea of communications and music coming together. Let's roll them.
Hey. Yeah, great. Bye.
The world's first phone with iTunes. 100 songs to go, only from Singular. Raising the bar.
I avoided the cringe in that quit just to show you the part that struck me, because I was not struck at all by the cringe. In fact, what struck me was like, isn't it funny that this nearly 20 years ago comes out and it's like, that's actually a very good version of a phone. That's the version of a phone that some people are building now. Like, you got these light phones and other products that are coming out that are just a phone, just music, trying to limit the use case to make this like a fundamentally positive a device in your life. I look at that and I think, that is exactly what I want my phone to be. I want to be able to listen to music. Of course, forget the wire for headphones. I want my headphones to be wireless. But I want to just jam out to music and talk to people on the phone. I don't need all these different apps and all that. That's exactly where the phone goes from servicing you to distracting. And so I found it so funny to think about, yeah, technically we got something way better, but now it's like things have come full circle a couple of decades later where people are actually trying to design dumber products like this so that people can only have the features they want. So that just made me think about like product innovation and where, you know, the natural tendency for capitalism to go to our basest desires as opposed to our more angelic selves. So that leads me into talking about VR and AI. Been a bunch of advancements the last couple of weeks with the release of Vision Pro, which is the Apple version of VR and AR, and the OpenAI releasing Sora, which is this is basically revolutionizing text to video and looks like it's going to be a absolute game changer in terms of what's possible on that front. And on both of them, I am skeptical of this iteration. And like, someone mentioned this. I can't remember where I heard it, otherwise I'd source it. But someone was saying, like, the thing about an iPad that made it successful is there was just two or three use cases that were just absolutely magical, picture perfect, and just blew 10x anything that was currently out there. And for me, there's some of these are just seem like low-hanging fruit that those should be out there, especially from an AI standpoint. Like a couple that come to mind. I was reading this book with my daughter. She's into these Secret Kingdom, and I was reading Fairy Tale Forest. Okay, let me see. The author is Rosie Banks, and the series. And there's like millions of these series. They go out. There's tons of them, and in this one, they had this, in this fairy tale forest, they have these things called book buds, and they're trees that grow books on them, okay? And so you tell stories to the trees. There's these book brownies that tell stories to the trees, and that helps the trees grow books as their fruit, essentially. And then they pluck them, and that's how they continue stories within this secret kingdom. Cool idea. Nice little party trick in this unicorn land that my daughter enjoys. It got me thinking from an AI standpoint, like so much of the AI is like good, but not quite good enough. Like interesting, like, oh, I can see how that could be good enough, but it's just not good enough. But it is good enough to write Secret Kingdom quality books, okay? Like this no offense to Rosie Banks, this is not Pulitzer Prize winning writing, okay? Like, we can't always be gasping. We can't, I mean, it's just, it's basic writing. AI could do this easily at this point. So why can't we, because just thinking of this book buds metaphor, like, there should be these easily an agent type use case where you come up, like, you could text a prompt what you want in the book, who are the characters, what you're looking for, even what you liked. You could feed whatever model, and they could create different iterations, work together to create personalized versions of this. Design your own stories with you in them, your world, things that you're aware of. Like literati, people were all signed up for these book boxes. Imagine you could get people, kids love series. The thing that they really love is they love getting into series, because then you don't have to reintroduce the characters. They can just, they know what's happening. They know who the main characters are. They know their tropes, etc. Why not design your own series? Just sign up, send a monthly prompt. They send you a book every three months. They send you the next one in the series. So easy to design these from an AI standpoint. Print them, send them in a box. This should be an absolute magical use case for a kid to be able to read stuff that contains their interests, but they feel like an agent in the creation. They feel like this feels personalized. Until there's a use case like that from AI where it's just absolutely killer, way better than anything you could have imagined or is possible in a world without AI, I'm just still waiting for that to happen. Similarly, like, I find it absolutely astonishing that ChatGPT doesn't have customer service embedded within the product. Like, they're trying to become this corporate solution. How do you keep, how do you sell to enterprises, get them to have corporate knowledge, et cetera? And if you have an issue with something that ChatGPT is doing, it actually can't solve your problem for you. There's no technical assistance. There's no customer support embedded within the product itself. And I find that to be, frankly, embarrassing. I don't know when it's coming, but it has to reach a point where your issues with the product should be able to be triaged, handled. Like, why is my model not giving me what I expect it to give in this situation? I saw this video of doing this. It should be able to troubleshoot that directly within the interface. That I shouldn't be having to go down Reddit forums or trying to watch YouTube videos to try to solve my problems with ChatGPT. I think it's embarrassing that they haven't focused on that as a killer use case. So anyways, those types of killer use cases haven't seen from an AI standpoint or really from a VR standpoint. Other than the VR, I'll give the airplane one a pretty big props. That would be cool as a way to chill out on an airplane. Put up a theater, watch whatever you want. But I think, yeah, there's going to be some interesting use cases coming out of that, but we're just not there yet. So that's my comments on some of the frontiers of technology. I think there's implications for education, but I'll just leave it there. I think there's still time to go. And it's frustrating because at this point, it's hard to tell whether it's worth investing, try to understand these tools, work with their flaws, or it's getting better at such a rapid pace that honestly, if you just wait a couple of years, we're going to have things that agents that are way more precise and way more just ready to use from a turnkey standpoint, instead of having to build up your own hard-earned wisdom with each particular tool. So that's that. Then the last thing I'll talk about is my new favorite internet think boy, Derek Thompson. I love his points of view. I just feel like I align very much with him in a lot of his points of emphasis. And this article, everyone should read. I'll link to it. It's called Why Americans Suddenly Stopped Hanging Out. Too much aloneness is creating a crisis of social fitness. I'll spare you the details of this, but basically across all ages, but especially amongst our teenagers, the amount of time spent socially with other humans has dramatically decreased and been replaced primarily by phone time. And the crisis from a mental health standpoint and what that means. Really, really well done article. And the thing that struck me is I have been trying to, one of the parts of the high school of the future, one of the aspects of it where I'm trying to really create a differentiated model is around the concept of mental fitness. And I'm trying to like popularize this term of mental fitness, where you think about our mental health, just like our physical fitness, where we're proactively thinking about what are we doing to take care of that? And what are the routines and lifestyles that we're going for that can enable a good mental fitness approach. So seeing social fitness, I was like, oh, maybe this could be the term. Maybe I should, it's still early enough. If this catches, you know, I saw it going viral, this article going viral on Twitter, but social fitness, maybe that's the right word that could be a broader umbrella for how to, you know, how best to convey what I think is going to be an extremely salient issue for the next generation, which is how do you develop, if you want to call it social fitness, how do you develop those skills in a world where technology is such a dramatically large proportion of your life. Anyways, I know I've gone too long here. I don't know if it'll be in this YouTube form, but I will make sure to keep this diary format going because I do want to record what the journey feels like and what are the thoughts, you know, as you're going through this process. So anyways, thanks a lot and I'll see you next time.